I once was teaching a class, as I frequently do. I asked the class, has anybody here ever had the experience of time slowing down, everything getting very peaceful, and you were extremely present and focused without fear, despite the fact that you may have been in great danger? And as is typical in that situation, several people raised their hands, yes. So I said, would anybody be comfortable talking about what that experience was like? One woman described an experience of almost drowning in the Kern River and going into a state like this, and as a result of that, she was able to survive. And she said an interesting thing. She said, if I could only have bottled that experience, I could have addicted the world to it. The fact is, a person can live their day-to-day life in that state. You can use your imagination to consider what kind of magnification of life that would bring. In most cultures, there's this idea of somehow lengthening life. The Western people had an idea of the fountain of youth. In the East, they had ideas of internal alchemy or different processes by which they thought that they could lengthen human life. If I were to come to you and say that I've got a process, it's going to take maybe a half an hour, maybe even an hour of your time each day or every other day. You have to keep it up for your whole life, but if you do this process, it will add 100 years to your life. That's a guarantee. Yeah, I think most people would say that's a pretty good deal. Of course, no such fountain of youth or internal alchemy actually exists. It's a myth. However, there is a process which will expand the scale of each moment of your life 2, 3, 4-fold bigger than it would be ordinarily. Then if you only lived for, let's say, 60 years, but you lived twice as big as the ordinary person lives, you would live the equivalent of 120 years. And that is doable. That is absolutely attainable by the average person. The central feature of any meditation system, the thread that holds them all together, all around the world, is that they develop this extraordinary degree of focus and presence. And therefore, they allow people to live their lives at this enhanced scale. So I would say that meditation in this sense is the most fundamental discipline or learning that any human being can undertake, because it is at the base of the pyramid of all of human endeavors. In science, they have a pyramid of hierarchy and power. Certain sciences are broader and deeper than other sciences. You may want to be a botanist, but if you want to be a really good botanist, you have to learn biochemistry. And if you want to be a really good biochemist, you have to learn physics. But if you want to really understand physics, you have to understand mathematics. Each of these sciences is a little broader and a little deeper. At the bottom of the pyramid of Western science is mathematics. It's hard to learn, takes time. But when you get it, you've got all of the sciences. What is at the bottom of the pyramid of all of human endeavors is the development of the concentration and focus skills. For one thing, if you have that, you can learn mathematics more effectively, and therefore you'd be a better physicist, and et cetera, et cetera. That was my case. I flunked all my science and mathematics courses in school, every one of them. There was a big bone of contention in my family. After practicing meditation for many years, I came back to it and discovered, as the result of the meditation, that I had concentration skills that I didn't have before. I was able to not only learn it quite well, but actually eventually teach it at the college level. If you have concentration and focus skills, you can apply it not only to mathematics, but you can also apply it to sports. Some people enter the meditative path simply because they want to improve their performance in their sports. That's a start. In fact, it's interesting that in the sports world, the sporadic states of high concentration that happen occasionally to athletes and are considered to be the peak of the athletic experience have a technical term, a locker room term. It's called being in the zone. Through systematic practice, you could do your workout or do your sports always in the zone. So you can apply it to learning mathematics. You can apply it to one's sports performance. There's no aspect of human life that you can't apply it to, and that's why people often have a lot of difficulty understanding meditation, because they say, well, what is it good for? Not realizing that it's good for everything. And they're very fixated on the specifics of what it's good for. It will allow you to be more present in your interactions with other people. It will allow you to understand yourself better, introspection, and it will allow you to pursue a spiritual path more effectively. So the entire range of human endeavors has at the base concentration and presence. And as I say, what meditation is about, systematically cultivating the strength of one's mind. Concerning this systematic cultivation, there are a lot of misconceptions and a lot of stereotypes. One stereotype or misconception is that there is a single meditative state. In point of fact, the meditative states represent a continuum from a rather light focus and concentration that almost everybody has experienced to profound states of special trance. Over the months and years that a person practices meditation, one of the dimensions in which they grow is the dimension of depth. One experiences the different stages along this continuum of deeper and deeper meditation. A second common misconception about meditation is that it's a state that you have when you're sitting still. And there's a whole association of meditation with a certain posture and a certain situation. In addition to the dimension of depth, there's a second dimension in which meditation grows, and we might call that a broadening. By that I mean that one maintains the meditative state automatically in more and more complex life activities. At first, meditation is one of the things you do as one of your life activities. Okay, you have all these things you do. One of them is you do a formal meditation practice. At some point, though, a figure ground reversal takes place. Instead of meditation being one of the things you do in daily life is contained within your meditative state. You just are there all the time. So sometimes you have funny experiences, like once they wanted to test my brainwaves as an experienced meditator. So I'm in this laboratory and they were hooking up these electrodes and they were saying, now don't go into meditation yet, as if somehow I could turn it off. Can Arnold Schwarzenegger shrink his muscles on command? Well, I mean, you can pump them, that's true, but you can't change the basic bulk that's there. So what they really meant was, you know, don't pump your meditation by intentionally going into some sort of state. I really had to chuckle because it was sort of like asking some bodybuilder to somehow get rid of the effect of all those decades of work that they've done until we're ready to measure you. It's an abiding state that is just with you in day-to-day life. At first, you may only be able to experience the enhanced focus and concentration under very simple circumstances. A metaphor here would be when people learn how to drive. When you first learn how to drive the car, all you can do is keep track of all that you need to do to drive the car. You can't do anything else. In fact, you could barely drive the car. I remember vividly learning how to drive, even though I come from Los Angeles. I learned how to drive rather late in life. I thought, I will never be able to do anything except maybe drive this car. The idea that I could drive the car and do other things at the same time, I couldn't conceive of it because it just took so much of my attention. So when you first learn how to drive the car, you go off into an empty parking lot. you learn those basic skills. When that has been internalized to a certain point, you can go on to a real road, but maybe one without too many cars. When you can negotiate that, you can go on to a road with some cars. And then at some point, you must graduate to driving on the freeways, at least where I come from. And some people never really graduate to that point. Their whole lives, they live in Southern California, but they're afraid to drive the freeways. Eventually, you've got to drive the freeway. In the same way, when you first learn how to meditate, yes, indeed, you may barely be able to get some of that enhanced presence and focus after sitting for a period of time still on a cushion. But with practice, it gets internalized. You're able to maintain it standing up, but only during that, and then you lose it at other times. And then you're able to walk around your room and still be in that state of high focus, but then you lose it at other times. And then you practice a little bit more, and you're able to do some activity, something simple, like clean the house, and you still feel that state that is the meditative state while you're doing this activity. In both East and West, in the monasteries, there's a tremendous emphasis on simple physical labor. If you're familiar at all with the Western monastic tradition, a lot of hard physical work done. The reason? That's a situation in between sitting still on the cushion and the complex activities of human interactions. With those simple jobs, they're attempting to meditate, to learn how to meditate in action. I remember vividly when I was first learning to meditate, they actually did not teach me how to sit on a cushion. They gave me the job of raking sand. If you've ever seen these raked sand gardens that you have in Zen temples, I was in Japan, and I was raking the sand. And I was getting really frustrated because I thought, I came here to meditate, and they're just making me do this dumb job of raking sand all day. Until finally some kind senior monk took me by the side and explained to me, this is the meditation. And I said, what do you mean? He says, well, when your mind wanders, come back to the sights, sounds, and body sensations of raking the sand. That's your concentration exercise. And if you do that, you'll start to get focused and you'll feel good. And of course, he was right. And then I started to do it, and you know, that was great. But I don't know if I would have ever caught on to that if somebody hadn't clued me in. So it's better to start out on the cushion. In any event, eventually one is able to maintain a meditative state doing complex activities, like talking to other people. And eventually one is able to maintain it doing really complex things, like delicate negotiations where a lot is invested emotionally, and you still are able to maintain a meditative state. On the analogy of learning how to drive the car, as the skills of driving the car become more and more second nature, you're able to negotiate more and more complex situations and to do other things at the same time. Finally, you can drive the car, listen to the radio, talk to somebody, and munch on a burrito all at the same time. The skill of driving has become completely internalized. In the same way, the skill of meditation eventually becomes completely internalized. It's just there all day. Life now becomes an activity embedded inside meditation. One stereotype to get rid of is that there is a single state called meditation. There is an extraordinary continuum of states. The second stereotype to get rid of is that meditation is something you do with your eyes closed, sitting still. That is formal exercise. Even great musicians still play scales. But we don't call scales the purpose of music. And even very experienced meditators still do formal sitting practices. But formal sitting practice is not the goal of meditation. The concert, the performance, is the goal of music. And in the same way, how one lives one's life is the goal of the meditation practice. I've spoken about the meditative state, how it has a sequence of depths, how it extends out into daily life. Let me see if I can make more tangible what I mean by the meditative state. Let's take some simple activity like washing the dishes. When you wash the dishes in the usual non-meditative way, your mind is going to the past, going to the future. Nothing wrong with that, but there's a kind of scatteredness. When you wash the dishes in a meditative state, your mind only goes to what is relevant to washing the dishes. What is relevant to washing the dishes? The tactile sensation in your body, the touch of the water, the touch of the dishes, the movements of the muscles is relevant to washing the dishes. The moment-by-moment visual impression of the dishes is relevant. The sounds of the water, of the dishes clacking, that's all relevant. And that's all that's relevant. Everything in the past and everything in the future is not relevant to that situation. You can get along without it. When you wash the dishes in a meditative state, as far as your mind goes, it only stays with what is relevant. There is a sense of uniting or merging with the activity of washing the dishes. And that merging is highly ecstatic to the mind. There is an intrinsic joy in that presence. And what's happening in the body while this happens is that the body is very settled and relaxed. A lot of the tension and hyperness in the body is gone. The body is relaxed into the activity of washing the dishes. And that produces a kind of pleasure in the body. So the mind is experiencing a kind of joy in the totality of that activity, and the body is experiencing a kind of pleasure in being relaxed into that activity. And also there's a peacefulness in the mind because it's not wandering all over the place. Another common misconception about meditation is that it is some sort of limiting of one's awareness, a narrowing of the focus. That is completely incorrect. Meditation is a limiting only in the sense that it is to focus on exactly what is relevant to a certain situation. What is relevant to a certain situation may be quite broad, or it may be quite narrow. The issue is that what is distracting, what is not relevant, what gets in the way, what takes energy away, what scatters one's being, that has been let go of. So there are some meditations that involve being aware of everything that is going on in all of the senses simultaneously. Obviously, there is no limitation there whatsoever. The heightened awareness and clarity is what makes that a meditative state. So when you wash the dishes, if you're fully present with just what is relevant to washing the dishes, you're in a meditative state. When you interact with another human being, what is relevant to that situation? There is an interplay. When they speak, what is relevant is their voice, their sounds. When you respond to them, what is relevant is your thoughts, your body sensations, your personality. But the problem is, when we have human interactions, we're usually quite scattered and attending to what is irrelevant, and therefore we can't be fully present with people. These would be some examples to make it a little bit more tangible what we mean by a meditative state. Anything could be a situation to cultivate a meditative state. A meditative state can be applied to any situation. I mentioned that when one has a meditative experience of washing the dishes, there is a certain special intrinsic joy in the mind and a relaxed pleasure in the body. But I also mentioned that meditation is a sequence of states. As one gets deeper and deeper into meditative dishwashing, one eventually comes to a point where one is so present with the activity of washing the dishes that there is a kind of merging of inside and outside. I'll be talking much more about that later on. When that happens, it becomes far more than merely an extremely joyous, pleasant experience. it becomes a spiritually meaningful experience, because one is getting insight into the nature of oneness of things. One is starting to break through the most fundamental illusion, or one of the most fundamental illusions, which is the illusion of separateness of inside and outside. At some point, even something as mundane as washing the dishes becomes both a vehicle for cultivating a profound spiritual transformation, and it becomes an expression of that profound spiritual transformation. Another common misconception about meditation is that it in some way involves only the mind. In point of fact, meditative states involve equally the mind and body. They impact both the mind and the body. The mind is impacted in the sense of being present and focused. The body is subjectively impacted in the sense of being relaxed and therefore experiencing a kind of pleasure. But there is an objective impact on the body that can be measured externally. There are physiological characteristics that are unique to the meditative state, and which, for example, separate it from a hypnotic state. People sometimes ask, what's the relationship between a hypnotic state and a meditative state? Clearly, there's a lot of overlap, subjectively. However, there are certain physiological changes that take place when a person meditates that don't take place necessarily when they're hypnotized. And one of the most interesting things is that scientists are studying these physiological concomitants of meditation. In fact, that's actually how I got interested in science. I mentioned my background in science wasn't too good in terms of my early upbringing. The reason that I eventually wanted to study science was that it came to my attention that scientists were studying meditative states. They were actually validating the subjective experience of meditators using objective empirical data that would be acknowledged by anybody in the world. And that, of course, was very confirming of my experience. So I thought this is something I should know about. Here are some of the basic physiological impacts that meditation has. First of all, it changes the breathing pattern. Most people start to breathe slower and deeper, although some people breathe actually more shallow. The salient feature, though, is that the hunger for oxygen is reduced. And this probably has something to do with the fact that when you're in a meditative state, you are processing everything more efficiently, and therefore your metabolic needs are reduced. You're doing more with less. Because when you're in a meditative state, you are not subtly, subliminally, in the depths of your being, interfering with yourself. At other times, the so-called non-meditative state, in which most people live their lives, involves an enormous amount of subconscious internal friction in all six senses: hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, the feeling body, and the thinking mind. As you learn to meditate more, that internal friction goes away or is lubricated away by the meditative state. One's whole being is functioning more efficiently. One of the reflections of this fact is that there's a change in the oxygen hunger. Most people breathe about 15 times a minute. On an average, somebody in a middle-level state of meditation is probably going to only breathe 4 or 5 times a minute. Somebody in a really, really profound state of meditation may not seem to be breathing at all. I once had an interesting experience. I lived with this Chinese master. His name was Wu Guang Fa Shi. Fa Shi means a Dharma teacher or meditation master. Wu Guang means awake to the light in Chinese. He was a sort of eccentric, but he was a real master. One of his eccentricities was that he rode a motorcycle, which is sort of unheard of for Chinese Buddhist monks. One day he comes back to the temple on his motorcycle, He says, I just went to the doctor to have my checkup. He told me that I wasn't alive. In other words, even in the midst of day-to-day activity, his metabolism was so efficient that the heart was so slowed down and the breath was so slowed down that in some ways he almost didn't have the vital signs of, you know, what you would expect of a normal person. This was a real master. I mean, this was a guy that never slept. He would lie down for 4 hours, but not lose consciousness. He'd sit for 4 hours, lie down for 4 hours, but not lose consciousness. And then the rest of the day, he would sit in his office, and a train of people would come in with problems, and he'd try to help them, either with spiritual or with special powers that he had cultivated. He was what we call a functioning bodhisattva. But in any event, that's an example of the impact on the breath and in the general metabolism. Another physiological concomitant of meditation is that there is a change in the electrical conductivity of the skin. It becomes less conductive. That seems to have something to do with the skin being drier because the sympathetic nervous system, which makes you sweat when you're nervous, is somewhat less active in a meditative state. But the most interesting physiological feature that can be objectively measured about a meditator is the change in the brainwaves. We have four patterns of brainwave: delta, theta, alpha, and beta. Delta is associated with dreamless sleep. Theta is associated with the state just leading to sleep called a hypnagogic state, when you see a lot of images and you're in the twilight zone. Beta is usually associated with being fairly agitated and frenetic. And alpha is associated with being relaxed but alert. That is the quick and dirty definition of a meditative state. If you ever need to explain to somebody real quick what's the difference between a meditative state and day-to-day life, it's real simple. Everybody knows what it's like to be alert. That's called, you know, drink some coffee and bop around town. You're real alert. Everybody knows what it's like to be relaxed. Go to sleep. If you imagine a state that contains both, the good part of both without the bad part of either, that would be a state that is both alert but relaxed at the same time. That is a meditative state. Growth in meditation is a growth in alertness, getting brighter and brighter and brighter, and relaxedness, getting more and more and more tranquil in the mind and body. Well, in any event, Western physiologists say that the alpha waves in the brain are associated with being alert and relaxed. So not surprisingly, we find that in meditators there is stronger alpha wave. However, that alone is not necessarily so surprising. There is something about the brain waves of meditators that is unexpected. Most people can only maintain a state of high alpha activity if their eyes are closed. If they open their eyes, it goes away. And standard textbooks on physiology had always held that this is part of the basic physiology of any human being. So they were very surprised to discover that meditators have extremely high alpha with their eyes wide open. That makes their physiology quite different from other human beings. Another physiological feature of the meditative state relates to the electrical activity in the muscles. There's something called an electromyograph, which measures what's going on in your muscles. If you look at the readout from the back muscles of an experienced meditator who has been sitting bolt upright for many hours, the muscles will appear to be as relaxed as the average person sleeping. So obviously some profound change is taking place in the physiology of the muscles to allow them to function and do a rather demanding activity, and yet at the same time be as relaxed as though they were asleep. This goes with that whole thing of the more efficient metabolism. Apropos of the brainwaves, there's one last thing I'd like to tell you. This was a piece of research that was a classic example of confirming the subjective report of a meditator with objective data. Zen meditators will tell you that when they sit and meditate, it seems like each moment is completely new and fresh. like they were just born that moment, moment by moment. Well, it sounds nice, sounds sort of poetic and attractive, but that's just their subjective report. They could be making that up. That could be part of the party line to get people interested. There are certain changes in the brainwaves that take place whenever a new and fresh stimulus impinges on a person. And as soon as that new and fresh stimulus is repeated a number of times, those brainwave changes stop. Then another pattern appears that is characteristic of something that is not a new impact in the sensory field. When they did the brainwave study on Zen monks, what they did is they hooked the Zen monks up to an electroencephalogram. They hooked another group of people up who were not meditators, but just sitting quietly up to a similar equipment. They introduced a click stimulus on a regular basis. When the click was first introduced for the meditators and the non-meditators, the brainwave change that indicates a new stimulus took place. And after a few clicks, that change no longer took place in the non-meditators. But no matter how many times they made the click, the Zen monks registered it objectively with the brainwave pattern associated with a new stimulus. Now, that's a very elegant experiment because it's absolutely objective. It's not based on somebody claiming a subjective experience. Well, it was things like that that got me intrigued in the whole aspect of how science could be used to explore and cross-fertilize with meditation. There are certain desirable physiological changes that take place in meditative states and are quite characteristic of them. This would seem to have an impact on health. I was told that on an average, they made some statistical studies and they found that, yes, indeed, the Zen masters in Japan did live quite a bit longer than the average person at whatever period of Japanese history they took the statistics. Some of these objective physiological changes seem to have something to do with health benefits. However, it's important to realize that meditating just for the health benefits would be a limited perspective on what meditation can bring. Another common misconception about meditation is that it involves a withdrawn state. It is true that in order to cultivate certain meditative skills, a person may spend periods of time, half hour here, a weekend there, a week over here, in states of silence and stillness. However, that is just to create an environment where optimal learning can take place due to the absence of distractions, even minor distractions. By sitting very, very still, one can learn much more effectively. And what has happened is, very unfortunately, because of the imagery of the person sitting perhaps with their eyes closed, silent, a certain archetype or preconception has spread into the general populace that looks upon meditation as this sort of autistic thing. So the most important thing to remember is that the meditation is something that can be cultivated, maintained, and applied in all life activities. And to get away from that stereotype that meditation is, you know, in this funny posture, sitting on the floor, the eyes are closed, you have to burn incense, and om. That's the image that you see of meditation in the mass media. Imagery is very powerful. That's an archetype. And that image, as I say, impacts so strongly that even when you explain to people very clearly what is involved in this practice, somewhere deep down in their subconscious, they still see it as a kind of withdrawal, a withdrawal from involvement in life, a withdrawal from involvement with other people. But of course, it is the diametric opposite of a withdrawal. Meditation is the skill of being fully present. Another common misconception about meditation is that it is a self-centered activity. Again, the imagery is impactful here. It seems like the person is sitting there just attending to themselves. So it seems selfish in some ways. So you might say that, to borrow the language of psychology, a lot of people look upon meditation as an autistic and narcissistic activity. It's autistic because you're withdrawn, okay, uninvolved, and it's narcissistic because you're just attending to yourself. You're just interested in yourself, your own subjective experience. In point of fact, in a sense, meditation is something a person does for themselves. But it is not only that. I have to laugh, actually, when I hear people say that, oh, meditation is self-centered and selfish. If you think about it, every moment of just about everybody's life is self-centered. It's true, isn't it? The only non-self-centered moments come during lovemaking, perhaps. Every once in a while, there's a non-self-centered moment. Actually, there are many non-self-centered moments every day, but people aren't aware of them. It's always going on. We're always being drawn out of ourselves and merging with the outside world, but people aren't aware of it. What most people are aware of could be called a sequence of narcissistic experiences. That's the normal. The person that sits down and meditates may look very narcissistic. They've taken time away to be for themselves. But actually, they're starting to come out of the narcissism that is the norm of the world. But unfortunately, as I say, the imagery tends to give an erroneous impression. However, it is true, as I mentioned, that meditation is something that we do for ourselves, but that's not all that it is. So in what sense is meditation something that we do for ourselves? In what sense is meditation something that is more than for one's individual self? Well, obviously, since meditation enhances any life activity, we meditate for ourselves so that we can have this special strength, so that we can work more joyously, more effectively, we can perform better, we can enjoy our meal better, we can enjoy music more. There is this sort of elevation of pleasure in life. When you eat your meal, if you're meditative, it's going to be much more pleasant to you. There's two ways to have good meals. One is eat in gourmet restaurants. The other is learn to be fully focused with whatever is there. Of course, that's not to say you couldn't eat in gourmet restaurants and be fully focused with what is there. You have the best of both worlds. Sure, all of our life is going to be magnified by our meditative abilities, and that's for us as an individual. Meditation can help us learn to experience physical and emotional pain with diminished suffering. That's for us as an individual. Meditation can give us an internal microscope with which we can explore ourselves at a very deep level, a level unavailable to non-meditators. That's something we do for ourselves to understand ourselves better. Ultimately, meditation can allow us to have a happiness independent of conditions. And that is one heck of an awesome claim. What do we mean by conditions? Just about everything is dependent on conditions. One's health is a condition. One's reputation is a condition. One's financial situation is a condition. One's having food to eat is a condition. Having air to breathe is a condition. The ability to think is a condition. It can be taken away from one, and it will be taken away from many people. It's called Alzheimer's disease. Or senility. If we're making a claim that ultimately meditation can bring a person to a sense of happiness and fulfillment that is independent of conditions. Well, this is an awesome claim. However, it is absolutely true. And ultimately, the thing that we do for ourselves in meditation is to come to that place of understanding, that state of consciousness, wherein our happiness is truly not dependent on conditions. You take away the health, you take away the wealth, you take away the reputation, you take away the air to breathe, you take away that person's ability to think, and they're still okay. My own personal experience is sort of interesting because I've actually experienced the ability to think being taken away from me chemically, in the sense that I don't have a thyroid gland. I have to take thyroid supplement every day. I was asked to be part of a study under very controlled conditions. I had to live in a hospital where I did not take my thyroid supplement for a while. They studied the metabolic pathways of the thyroxine, but they needed, basically, I just had to pee in a bottle, you know, and not take my thyroid, so I could meditate or study or do whatever I wanted. It was a pretty good deal, and I agreed to it because they had helped me with my thyroid condition, so I'll be part of your experiment, and I was curious what would happen to my state of consciousness, because a person that doesn't have a thyroid, if they don't get their supplement, they develop a condition called myxedema madness. Basically, it's a form of senility. Your IQ drops way down, about 40, I would guess. Now, they can take you right to the edges of that state. So it's roughly, in some ways, equivalent to Alzheimer's disease. They can take you right to the edge of that, and the good thing is they can yank you back. As soon as you start taking the thyroid supplement, you recover from that state. That's what they did. They took me right to the edge of dementia and then pulled me back. I was able to prove to myself that the meditative state goes beyond the chemistry of the brain, the physical nature of the brain, at least to a certain extent. I suspect that if that time they had taken me further out, that maybe I wouldn't have been so happy. However, now, 15 years later, probably I could go a lot further out and still have my happiness be independent of conditions, including the condition that I know how to organize a thought. Because you can't think in that state. You don't know who you are. You don't know what's anything. The ultimate thing that meditation can do for the individual is show them how their happiness does not need to be dependent on conditions. Now, you might wonder, it sounds like two things. It sounds extremely abstract. It sounds pretty audacious as a claim. Let me see if I can make that a little more tangible. When does a person have their happiness not dependent on a condition? Is whenever they are having a complete experience. Whenever you have a complete experience of something, the entire universe is present in that experience. Your individual identity is merged with, on one hand, the entire universe, and on the other hand, with the source of the universe. Any ordinary experience, like washing the dishes, when it is experienced completely, becomes absolutely extraordinary. The state that is beyond conditions is just whatever is happening, but experienced completely. The ultimate stage in the sequence of meditation deepenings comes when one starts to have during the day moments of complete experience. Inside a complete experience, time, space, self, and world, all of creation and the source of creation are all contained. Now, I know that probably didn't make it much more tangible to you. Throughout this series, I'll be talking more and more in detail about such things, and hopefully it will be quite tangible to you by the time you've completed this series. Yes, indeed, part of meditation is something we do for ourselves. At many levels, including the ultimate level of transcending our limited identity, most people, their identity is limited to their thoughts and feelings, their mind and their body. The thinking mind and the feeling body, that is the prison in which most people live. To transcend that limited identity so that the mind and body become a home that you can go in and out of rather than a prison that you're stuck in, that is another way to describe having complete experience or going beyond conditions. On one end, meditation is something we do for ourselves, to have complete experience, to experience an identity larger than our thoughts and feelings. On the other hand, meditation is something that we do for others. The aspect of meditation that we do for others is absolutely of equal importance. In what sense is meditation something that we do for others? There is a basic pattern on this planet that underlies almost all of our problems, big or small, individual or global. But the pattern is so basic that most people aren't really aware of it. As the proverbial expression goes, they cannot see the forest because of the trees. People tend to be so locked into the specifics of situations that they don't see the big picture. But when you look back and look at the really big picture, what is the basic structure that underlies our individual and collective problems as human beings? The basic structure is as follows. An objective situation presents itself. Okay, that could be anything. Okay, an illness, a loss, a difficult interaction with another person. An objective situation presents itself. It impacts on our thoughts and feelings. Out of those thoughts and feelings, which are subjective, an objective response comes. We do something. We take action in one way or another. The problem is that very, very few human beings have much skill in dealing with their subjective experience. What do I mean by skill? I mean that very, very few human beings have the ability to experience anger, fear, sadness, embarrassment without suffering. And very, very few human beings have the ability to experience confusion without freaking out. So when a situation presents itself, and it produces anger, fear, sadness, embarrassment, confusion, we suffer. However, it is absolutely possible to experience anger, fear, sadness, confusion without suffering, to experience them completely. When we have a complete experience of physical or emotional pain, it doesn't cause suffering. It's a paradox. When we have a complete experience of confusion, it leads to an intuitive insight into things. It's a paradox. Complete experience is extremely paradoxical. But most human beings are not capable of having many conscious, complete experiences. When objective situations present themselves, it causes subjective states which are not experienced completely, therefore often turn into suffering. The salient feature of suffering is that it distorts behavior. You cannot perform the delicate act of threading a needle while at the same time somebody is holding a flame to your body. Can't do it. Your whole body shakes. The object of activity is distorted because of the suffering. In the same way, the delicate act of human interactions, human communications, is constantly subject to the distorting influences of subliminal suffering, suffering that human beings are going through without even knowing they're going through it. So the responses are less than optimal, less than what they could be. What meditation allows is for us to have complete experiences, complete subjective experiences. Therefore, the suffering and therefore the distorting influence is then vastly reduced so that our responses become much more appropriately modulated, become more optimal to the situation. The responses are less than optimal. They sow the seeds for a new objective situation that's going to be a problem. And then, of course, we, as human beings, respond to that new situation, suffering, perhaps not even knowing it, and therefore have a less than optimal outcome from that situation. Now, often this cycle can just spin without getting out of control because the distorting influences are small. But those distorting influences can add up. In this culture, the norm is to go from passionate love to acrimonious divorce in just 5 or 10 short years. What happened? What happened? What happened was dozens and dozens of interactions daily, some of them kind of neutral, some of them a little bit charged, some of them charged in big ways. The ones that were charged unpleasantly caused suffering. One responded to the situation with perhaps small or perhaps big distortions. But even if the distortions were small, they build up over time, the proverbial waxy buildup that they talk about in ads, okay? Even though the distortions may be small, the responses are one yells when one merely needs to be emphatic, one hits when one merely needs to yell, in the extreme cases one kills where one merely needs to hit. Even if it's just a matter of subtle stuff, the tone in the voice, the quality of the body language, forget about yelling or hitting, it builds up. That cycle builds up. It escalates, the proverbial vicious cycle. It is the buildup in that cycle that destroys a relationship here, a career there, that leads to an ethnic cleansing over here, or a dictatorship over there, a war over here, a famine over there. The basic pattern. When a person becomes proficient in meditation, they begin to pull out of that basic pattern. Situations arise, causes feelings. The feelings are complete in that moment. The responses are more appropriate than they would have been otherwise. The distortions don't build up. Life goes on as it was meant to go on. I started to meditate back in the 60s. The catchphrase was, you're either part of the problem or the solution. It's a very good expression. You're either part of the problem or you're part of the solution. Of course, part of the solution meant to be politically correct. That may be part of being part of the solution, but there's something much more fundamental. Being part of the solution on this planet means snipping that cycle by the way, that cycle has a name. That's called the law of karma. Snipping that cycle, and where do you snip it? Well, most people can't snip it because they just won't put in the time and effort needed to cultivate the subjective skills that are going to allow them to metabolize the subjective experiences that come from objective situations and therefore be able to respond more skillfully to the objective situations. Most people aren't willing to spend that amount of time. And then they wonder why things get so messed up individually and collectively. Like a woodcutter whose job it is to cut wood, sees the first tree, hacks away, sees the next tree, hacks away, refusing to spend 20 minutes each day to sharpen the axe, and then wonders why he can't cut as much wood as he should be able to, and wonders why it's such hard work, never realizing he's using a dull tool, a less than optimal tool. This is the general human condition if we want to look at the big picture. One of the things that meditation achieves for the others in our life is that it pulls us out of that cycle. There's more to it than that, though. I'll be talking further on about how not only does meditation allow us to stop being part of the problem, but it also allows us to start being part of the solution in the terms that it leads to the development of qualities in the Buddhist tradition are called metta and karuna, which means friendliness and compassion. On one hand, yes, indeed, we do meditation for ourselves. Ultimately, we do it for ourselves so that we can have the relative happiness of enhanced pleasure and diminished suffering, and so that we can have the absolute happiness, which is the happiness independent of conditions. It comes about when we can experience a condition completely. On the other hand, equally importantly, we do meditation so that we can stop being part of the problem on this planet, at least to a certain extent, and so that we can start to be part of the solution. Now, of course, one might say, well, love, loving kindness, friendliness, compassion, if these are the ultimate goals, why bother with all of that hard work, developing concentration power, all the struggle and time that involves? Why not just start with the path of love and service right off the bat? The issue is one of optimization. If one only is involved in the path of love and service, this isn't a bad thing, but it's highly probable that one is going to be subject to burnout. One is going to be subject to disappointments. You try to help people and they bite the hand that feeds. What do you do? Ultimately, if one attempts to just practice the path of love, service, and compassion without at least some meditative work, one is likely to have one's activities of love, compassion, and service get distorted, perhaps in small ways, perhaps in big ways. If you think about the history of religions, especially religions in the West, they start out with great ideas about being the path of love. Somewhere along the line, they end up involved in inquisitions, crusades, persecutions, jihads, pogroms, in the name of what? In the name of God's love. When we look back at it, of course, it seems so perverse, so obviously perverse. How did it happen? How did it happen? It's exactly the same mechanism that was present in our individual life that in 5 years, 10 years, leads a person from passionate love to acrimonious divorce. But this is just a bigger pattern. Over longer periods of time, involving more people, over decades, centuries, involving populations, ethnic groups. Same pattern, though. You start out with your religion is a path of love, and amazingly, you can end up torturing the children of heretics because of an inability to be objective about your own thoughts and feelings, your own belief system, and the anger, fear, sadness, etc. that may come about when people aren't quite willing to accept your version of love.